I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
And I'm Gail King. Hey, this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the CBS This Morning podcast. Well, it has happened again. We had another great author on the program just this morning. And as always the case when somebody's really good, well, we like to think everybody's good that comes on the show, but I have to say some are better than others. And so we ran out of time in a really important conversation. The name of the book is called Forge in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. And you are?
Nancy Kane.
Nancy Kane. Although, Nancy, I have to say this. After you left the studio, one of the floor guys, the crew guys, who I trust implicitly for everything, they said, what's her last name? Nancy Kane. You should call her Nancy Hurricane. Wow. What a force. That's the impression you had on the crew this morning. Because you've written a book and you're talking about leadership and you decided to highlight five different leaders in our time. And you chose them because not only because of their leadership, but that they still have, there are still ramifications, that their influence is still being felt today. Can you just say the five names quickly and then we'll go into a little bit on each of them. The five names, let's start with.
You bet. The Antarctic explorer, Ernest Shackleton.
Yes.
Our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
The escaped slave and very important abolitionist, Frederick Douglass.
Yep.
The Nazi resisting clergyman, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And the environmental crusader, Rachel Carson.
Rachel Carson. Now, of all those five, who do you think would be my favorite? And do not say Frederick Douglass, although I love him.
Well, I wanted to guess Frederick Douglass, but I have inside information that it's Ernest Shackleton.
Yes, because listen, Nancy, I've read about him, you know, down in history, I've read, but I didn't really know anything about him. He was by far my favorite. And I'm embarrassed to say, both Nora and I said, who is Rachel Carson? I had never heard of her. So we'll get into them in just a second. But the thing that struck me about this book is that you said all of these leaders are made, not born. Because there are some people that believe that, you know, all good leaders are born with it. You can't teach someone how to be a good leader. And to that you say?
I say poppycock. These leaders learned, they made themselves, these people made themselves into people capable of doing the impossible. Or as I say in one of the introductions, in part of the introduction of the book, these were ordinary people who forged themselves into people capable of doing extraordinary things.
You said, and they all raised a bar for their followers, all of these leaders.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, David Foster Wallace, the American writer, once said that great leaders are individuals who help us overcome the limitations of our own weaknesses and selfishness and laziness and fears and get us to do harder, more important, better things than we can get ourselves to do on our own. And each of these five people did that.
Now, you start with five people. You have five people. But, Nancy, there's only one woman. And you and I are women.
Of course.
And well, so I said, Nancy, what happened?
Well,
were there no great women leaders?
Oh, there are many, many great women leaders. I considered, for example, Gloria Steinem.
Yes.
Or Katharine Graham.
But how did Rachel Carson make the cut? And she was only one of the five.
Well, she made the cut because the reason all the other four made the cut, and that was I wanted to tell a book about how they made themselves, you know, extraordinary by working from the inside out, from their humanity, from their emotional awareness, from the effects of crisis and their dedication to making something good from that crisis. And so I needed people that had left an emotional record. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't sound like it's that hard, but lots of folks don't leave diaries, don't have poignant letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that in the case of all these people, and particularly in the case of Rachel Carson.
Well, her adversity, she had cancer. And it never comes at a good time, but in her particular case, it really wasn't a good time. We're talking to Nancy Kane, Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Start us off with Rachel Carson.
So Rachel Carson was a scientist in the 1930s when women didn't go to college. If they went to college, they didn't finish college. They certainly didn't
become... In the 1930s?
When she's coming of age.
And, oh, okay.
And she becomes a biologist. And again, in a time when women didn't do that. And she works her way through a number of organizations, particularly the Fish and Wildlife Service. And then in the late 1950s, she gets wind of this really fascinating and frightening issue around pesticide use. DDT, heptachlor, and these chemicals that are being sprayed all over American crop fields and all over American households. And she says, I need to find out what's going on here. And she starts writing a book called Silent Spring that ultimately becomes a book that rocks the world, published in 1962. And in the middle of that, as you point out, Gail, She is diagnosed with aggressive metastasizing cancer. Yeah. And so the story of the chapter is her race against the clock to finish what she believes is an incredibly important book.
And ultimately, she died at a very young age, too.
Absolutely. She dies of complications from the cancer at the age of 56 in 1964, but not before. The book comes out, calls millions of Americans to a new kind of environmental stewardship, and really lays the groundwork for all the landmark environmental legislation that we know today.
But you also let us go into Rachel's personal life. She had a sister who died. She had a niece who was having an affair with a married man who has a baby, and then the niece dies, and then Rachel becomes, you said, his de facto mother. Right. So we got to see a little bit of her personal side, too.
Absolutely, because her story, like so many of our women's stories, is a story not only of juggling lots of professional balls and moving big mountains, it's also the story of caring for people, right, and running a home and dealing with all those conflicting obligations that are so powerful and women are so dedicated to discharging in a very real important way.
So you talk about Rachel's crisis, but the thing that struck me as interesting, you said all of these leaders, and most leaders, you say, are all faced with crisis at some point.
Absolutely, and I think that's an important part of their making, is what they learn and discover about themselves in the midst of great volatility, in the midst of what I call the perfect storm of high winds and big waves.
And how they handle the crisis.
Absolutely, how they yeah. navigate through
yes.
it, and
yes.
at the same time say, there's something I need to get better about in the midst of this terrible situation, and that ends up having lasting impact on what they become.
And in the middle of the crisis, and all of them had a crisis, they sort of embraced it, even though they were afraid. I thought that was interesting. They were afraid, too.
They were really afraid, like all of us. And one of the interesting things I discovered, Gail, I didn't know this when I started, is each of them step into the fear, right?
Yes.
Step into it,
yes.
just a small step. And that actually ends up in making them a little braver,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they master or they move into something they were really anxious about, and that becomes part of the making as well.
Did facing a crisis and embracing it and going through it resonate with you?
Well, it did, because what's not in the book is that I wrote the book out of, I reached for Lincoln, I reached for Shackleton as a historian because I was going through terrible personal crises. My father,
can you share?
You bet. My father dropped, this is all within two and a half years. My father dropped dead. My husband.
Of what? Heart attack?
Of a heart attack. One day, just dropped dead on the kitchen floor.
How old?
72.
Mm-hmm.
My mother went to pieces because she didn't know how to live without him. 4 months later, my husband, whom I loved more than anything, decided I was the problem in his life and walked out and wanted
Whoa.
All the Harvard retirement money that I'd earned in 20 years at teaching at Harvard.
Whoa, how long had you two been married?
14 years.
Whoa.
Walked out. Uh-huh. I don't love you anymore. My lawyer will try and take what I deserve.
Nancy, you had no idea that he was feeling
I knew he was depressed.
Yeah.
I knew he was frustrated about his career. I didn't know he hated me.
Wow.
It was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I lost 20 pounds in 20 days. My students were calling me the disappearing Professor Kane.
Yes. Nobody wants that diet. I've had that diet, too.
Yeah, right? That's not a diet you want.
No,
ever.
You don't. Where
not
I came
when it's
home,
that bad.
I came home and caught my ex a cheater, pumpkin eater. I had no idea either that there was something like that going on. And it does. It throws you. You can lose a lot of weight when you're going through crisis over a man.
Over a man.
So you had your father.
My father, my husband.
Then did you all have children?
We had no children, just the dogs. He didn't want them. And then the bitter divorce, because I'm from nothing, so I was trying to keep my retirement money.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of the bitter divorce, I developed breast cancer with no risk
Nancy.
No risk factors.
Wow.
Stay with me. And then less than 3 years later,
wow.
I developed breast cancer again. And the oncologist at Dana-Farber said, geez, wow, we didn't expect this to happen. And so I was on my knees like some of the folks in my book. And in the middle of it, before the second cancer diagnosis, I reached for Lincoln. I didn't know much about Lincoln.
Yeah.
And I started reading some of his late writings, his speeches,
uh-huh.
his letters.
Uh-huh.
And I began saying to myself, maybe it sounds naive, but Nancy, you think you have problems. Mr. Lincoln had things much worse
yeah.
than you did. And that was the beginnings of the book.
Wow.
How do people get through what seemed like, you know, breath-robbing,
yes.
life-annihilating,
soul-crushing,
that's the best adjective, yeah. soul-crushing crises. And that, so the book came partly from within me.
Wow, Nancy. Do you feel you came out okay on the other side?
I did, because I learned that, like the folks in this book, they helped teach me, don't get bitter,
yeah,
don't get smaller, find some good diamonds in the rough of all that adversity and pass on the light you can discover in yourself to others. So I partly wrote this book because I wanted...
I noticed you didn't say get even.
Oh, no. I think, you know, in the end, what is it? Living well is the best revenge,
is the best revenge. Well, let's jump into Lincoln's story. That's quite a story you're telling about yourself. Wow, that is a lot to go through.
It was a lot.
That is a lot. May I say, you seem better for it, because look at you today. Gorgeous, and they're calling you Hurricane. That ain't so bad. I mean,
they taught my fabulous five, my fantastic five, as my editor said, taught me a lot. They live with me.
Let's just say, listeners, by the time Nancy left the studio, Charlie was saying, could you get her contact information? Because I think he's thinking she should be on the Charlie Rose Show. I'm not speaking for him, but he did ask for your contact information. We are talking to Nancy Kane. She's author of the book Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. So you said you reached out to Lincoln. Now, Lincoln suffered through depression.
Serious depression all his life. He called it the hypo, but there were moments in his life, including during his presidency, when he threatened to kill himself. Mm-hmm. At one point early in his life, his best friend cleared his life and his pockets and his room of razors because he didn't want him to hurt himself. Mm-hmm. When he was president at one point, you know, one of his dear cabinet, the person he was closest to in the cabinet, Edwin Stanton, and his dear devoted secretaries, John Nicolay and John Hay, are taking very careful care of him when they know he's reached the hypo, as he called it, has affected him.
What was his biggest crisis for the purposes of your book?
I think the biggest crisis for him was in the middle of 1862. The war's going terribly for the Union Army. The slavery has reached a kind of tipping point in terms of public opinion about its importance in the war. He doesn't know what to do mm-hmm. about this extraordinary moral and political problem. And he is, as he said later, he said, I was out of cards, but I was resolved to find the last one rather than lose the game. And the last card, and here's the really interesting thing, mm-hmm. becomes the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yes.
And when Lincoln decides to
say I'm in favor?
Yeah, maybe we all say, right?
Yes. But
we all say, and it seems it doesn't seem radical at the time, but it was still a radical move because two reasons. One, it changed the war into a war that wasn't just to save the Union with slavery in the South. It was a war to end slavery and restore America to its original promise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Equality for all. But the second piece that's really interesting from a personal standpoint, Gail, is that once Lincoln had made that decision, which he made thoughtfully, mm-hmm. haltingly,
yes.
carefully,
yes.
there was no way he was going to back down.
Yeah.
So that is really important. A leader who's not going to vacillate,
yeah.
right, no matter what the polls say.
Even though he had a lot of opposition. You said he had the unique ability to sort of step aside, step yeah. outside of himself, and walk around and take it all in, that he literally would do that.
Right.
And you know, mentally and physically, it sounded
he would. And I talk, when I coach executives, I talk about, just think about it. Detach yourself for a minute. Take
yes,
a yoga breath.
Detach, yes.
Turn the phone over and put it down mm-hmm. and walk around this moment and your role in it mm-hmm. and then see what you want to do. Then mm-hmm. think about what you want to do. But don't take action in the heat of the emotionally charged
yes.
moment.
Yeah. Some others could take a cue from that, but we'll talk about
yes.
that in just a second. Let's jump to Frederick Douglass because, yeah. as you point out, of all the leaders that you talked about, these are the only two that actually met each other. Let's talk about Frederick Douglass.
So,
I loved his story.
Many of your listeners know Frederick Douglass, you know, abolitionist,
yes.
arguably one of the most important leaders in the 19th century.
And he was so young at the time.
He was so young. He escapes from slavery when he's barely 20, and he becomes really a national figure by the time he's 30.
But before that, talk about, this is what I thought was interesting, the things that he saw as a little boy that changed his life, the abuses. I don't think people really understand the harsh realities, the abuse, the really pain and the
suffering,
the brutality of slavery.
So that is
and you point out the things that he saw as a little kid
so
that really
he saw
him.
Extraordinary things, and it changed him and it made him determined.
Like, extraordinary things like?
So when he's a little boy, he sees his aunt, who's a slave, her shirt is stripped off, her arms are tied above her head to a hook in the kitchen, and her master, who's angry with her for being late or something trivial, lashes the heck out of her back. She's
yeah.
screaming. She can hardly stand up before he releases her. And the child watching this is 8 years old
right.
in a little closet peeping out. And he said, then I knew what slavery really was.
Yeah.
Or slave auctions, where mothers were separated from toddlers,
yeah.
screaming and begging their owners to buy their child.
To buy the family.
Well, and in one case, you know, another word, just kick that woman right. down to the ground. I mean, this is, we don't realize today the extraordinary, as you said, brutality of the fact that Americans owned other Americans.
Yes, yes. And I love, this is why I so like Frederick Douglass and his story, because he moved to Britain where he became an accomplished speaker. He was educated. You know, he had a slave owner who encouraged him to read. He learned to read. He was a great reader and great writer. He moved to Britain, and he was really doing very well over there. And he realized that he had to make the decision. He could either live in Britain or come back to the United States. And as difficult as it was, he came back to the United States knowing what he was going to face when he got here.
He moved into the fear, right? But also knowing, and this is important for a lot of these leaders, that you and this is important for leaders to say, where can we make the most difference?
Yeah.
Where is our place on the stage? How do we use our unique gifts? This is something leaders have to constantly be mindful of. And Douglass says, you know, it's safe. It's, I have lots of celebrity status in England. There's a good abolition movement. I can make a difference, but not as great as if I go back to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Diedrich Bonhoeffer also faced a very difficult decision.
An analogous decision, although I didn't know it when I started the story. His friends,
Tell us who he is.
He's a clergyman who comes of age in Berlin. He's a Lutheran minister and resolves to resist Hitler from the time the Nazis take power.
Yes.
And he works within an alternative church to do that for 6 years, and then decides that he actually needs to take even greater action. He's not having enough effect. But his friends decide he's become too hot in terms of his visibility to the Gestapo mm-hmm. and the SS, and they're worried he's going to be arrested and possibly executed. And so they send him to the United States.
And how old is he at this time?
He is 30, let's see, he born in 1906, so he is 36.
Yeah.
33, excuse me.
He was also young.
He's also young. So, and they spirit him off to the United States, and he gets to the United States where he has a fellowship at the Union Theological Seminary right here in New York, and he's here for 2 weeks, and he gets agitated, and he says, I can't be here when there's a struggle mm-hmm. against evil in my own country. I have to go back and be with my brethren in this struggle. And he takes the last ship out of New York bound yes. for Germany before the Second World War breaks out.
You said all of them face crisis. All of your leaders that you highlight in the book face crisis they didn't see coming, and they walk through it. And that's a good example of that for him.
Absolutely.
For him. And the last leader that you highlight is my favorite, because I have only, you know, you hear about him in history books, but I didn't really know much about him. Tell us about Mr. Shackleton.
Ernest Shackleton was an Antarctic explorer, and in end of 1914, he takes a ship to Antarctica yeah. with the idea of walking across, being the first men to walk across the continent. And they are just about ready to land, 80 yeah. miles from shore,
yeah.
in January of 1915, and icebergs trap the ship like a vice, and the ship can't move. And eventually, 6 months later, the ship goes down
yeah.
through the ice.
And they watch it go down.
And they watch it go down. They're absolutely devastated.
They're not on the boat, because by now they're off the boat.
They've abandoned the ship because yeah. it's being crushed by the ice.
Right.
They're in lifeboats. They're in lifeboats. Mm-hmm. They have 3 lifeboats, tents, canned goods. They don't have Waze. They don't have text messaging. They have no, like, you know,
yeah.
podcast to find their
yes.
way home.
Yes.
And he has somehow, against all odds, to get himself and his 27
men on
home
board
to safety. And
they
does.
Drift, too. They drift. They are like 800 miles out or something.
They drift, and they drift because they've got tents set up on icebergs. Eventually, the ice breaks, and they sail to a deserted island northwest of Antarctica called Elephant Island, and Shackleton says, no one's going to find us here.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of food.
So we have to go.
So we have to make one of these lifeboats into a sailboat capable of sailing 800 miles to the nearest point of civilization, which is a little island called South Georgia, northeast of the west coast of Antarctica. And again, against all odds, he and 5 other men pilot this tiny 24-foot boat
yeah.
all that way.
You know what was so great about this story that really struck with me is that you said, as a leader, your followers are always watching you. They're watching your expressions. They're watching what you say. They're watching your energy. They watch how you conduct yourself. And he noticed that early on.
He knew that early on. And what he understood that we want leaders to remember today,
yes.
right, is that everyone is taking cues, not just from what you say or the choices you make, but how are you holding your body?
Yes.
Are you looking at your phone when you walk by them?
Yes.
Right? Are you looking confident and open, or are you looking, you know, closed and
are
disengaged?
Are you looking worried?
Are you looking worried because people are confident largely in relation to the leader's confidence.
You talk about him getting up in the middle of the night and pacing the ice while everybody was sleeping.
He was so nervous, but yeah. He never let his men see him sweat. Yeah. So he literally, before he got out of that tent in the morning, he like squared his shoulders, yes. Tightened his core and walked out, because he knew as soon as he walked out, everyone would be looking for what's the boss feeling today? What's that mean for our chances of survival?
Yeah, so he even tried to make mealtime, you write, a bonding experience. He realized that he had to bond with every man on his crew from the highest in rank to the lowest in rank, and made a point of bonding and forging a relationship.
Absolutely.
Even though he was scared out of his mind.
Absolutely. They never let him see your sweat. Yeah. Because he wanted them to, first of all, feel like his will to survive was their will. That's part of leading from your humanity. Their will to survive. And also to think that they were whole, right? All for one and one for all. Because nothing can kill a good, worthy cause like discord and dissension and divisiveness among the team or the citizenry.
We are talking to Nancy Kane. She's the author of Fortune Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. And something tells me, Nancy Kane, we have not met before, but something tells me you're a never let him see you sweat girl, are you?
I tried.
I'm following off of Edward Shackleton. Are you a never let him see you sweat girl?
I am, and I learned it from my Fantastic Five leaders. I am. My students don't see me sweat. I want them to be credibly inspired, because we need our young people to go out and embrace a worthy cause and get down with their strongest leader side.
And what are the lessons you think we could take from your research of the Five? That would be relevant today.
One really important lesson is one you spotlighted at the top of the conversation, Gail, and that is, how do we help others do better, harder, more important things than they can get themselves to do on their own? Yeah. That's really important. We're all looking for that, and we've all had it. Teachers, coaches, rabbis, ministers, we need to become those people for others. That's mm-hmm. the first thing. Mm-hmm. Second thing, sometimes, as you alluded to earlier, nothing is the most powerful something a leader can do. So each of these people learn.
That's actually on page 442. That's what you said, Nancy.
But
Kane.
These, exactly.
You said that. But you said, wait a minute, let me find it. At times, in italics now, doing nothing at all was the best action each of these leaders could take.
So Lincoln gets all kinds of crazy mail coming at him. Everyone's angry. The country's more divided then than it is now. He gets really frustrated with his generals, really angry, really insulted. And at some of his most emotionally intense moments, and we know this because we have the record, he'll write a letter of anger and disappointment to a powerful person, then he folds it up and he puts it in his desk drawer where it was found. There were a number of these after he died. And I often think...
And it was like unsigned and unsent.
Exactly.
It said. Yeah.
And I often think, God, we need our political leaders, including our president, to take a page from Lincoln's book, don't hit send, don't hit post. Let the storm die down, because we don't want, by reacting in the heat of the moment, to do destructive, to act, to create destruction for our followers or for our cause.
And I will end with this, because it was my favorite line in the book on page 447, when you talk about your Fantastic Five, because I so think that we're in short supply of this today. 447, you know where I'm going. 447. I underlined it now. Okay. Part of the reason that these five ordinary people could do extraordinary things was that they led from their humanity. I feel humanity is in such short supply these days, and I love that you pointed that out in your book. I thank you for that.
Well, it was my privilege. It's so important, right? These are all very human people. Lincoln sang body songs to keep away the anxiety, right?
Lead from your humanity. Nancy Kane, hey, do you like being called Nancy Hurricane? I think that's kind of cool.
I like that, Miss Galen. Yeah. Thank you, and God bless you for
that
reading
was
my book.
Cool. The name of her book is Fortune Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times, wherever you like to buy your book. And it's Nancy Kane with an unusual spelling, because I thought you were Cohen. Nancy, K-O-E-H-N. So don't look for a Kane, C-A-N-E, or K-A-N-E. It's Nancy, K-O-E-H-N.
As in hurricane.
As in hurricane, since I know that you can't see it. Thank you, Nancy Kane.
God bless you, Gail. Thanks.
You too.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.
For more information, please visit cbsthismorning.com.